hear my rushing blood and creaking bones. I slipped into the passenger seat beside Father. He finally looked at me, switched the car into first. My stomach roiled. I thought they were my friends, I said. They are. I like to imagine that Owen ran out to the street as we pulled away, his hand outstretched. But of course, I could not see him. Father has been apologizing to Lenz's family. It is a family as small as mine. A family that has only a father, a man who wrings large hands and frowns. Father does not ask whether they want to press charges. Neither man says anything of the kind. Of course, they would not do so in front of me. God, does this waiting room haunt me? It looks like all waiting rooms. I cannot talk. I scribble in this notebook. I hope that no one will speak to me. Half an hour ago I met Lenz's father. Afterward I had to run to the restroom to vomit up the shameful bile in my stomach. I clung to the toilet bowl and gagged. The sound echoed and illuminated nothing so much as my own face, creased in self-disgust. Because I have seen Lenz's father before. I recognize those hands of all things. I recognize them for their crevices. They are a baker's hands. I knew then who Lenz was. How I made him scream as a child in the bakery. How I made him scream and scream at the nothingness of me. And suddenly Lenz's hatred makes some sort of sense to me. I left the room to sit in the hallway, tried not to overhear my father or the baker. I rested my elbow on my knees, my chin in my palm, listened to the feet of the hospital staff as they passed by, the familiar swishing of scrubs and squeaking of plastic shoes. I listened, and my throat burned. And I knew I was on the sidelines again, Ollie. The lightest of footsteps drew near. A set of unfamiliar tennis shoes appeared. "Budge over!" Fika slumped into the chair beside me, diminished without her boots. I swallowed. "Thank you for coming." "Pfft, I didn't want to. Owen wouldn't stop tugging my arm and staring at me with his freak eyes, and finally I agreed to let him follow after his eyeless loser of a girlfriend. No offense, Brilla." I felt her lean over to look at me. Why is the act of looking so vital to other people? Why is it so vital to me? Because I can never look away. I spent so long being unseen. Until you wrote me, no one would follow me to dark places. Fika wore a knitted sweater pocked with holes, and her eyes were always narrowed, but she was here. Someone normal might have hugged her. "Owen's in the bathroom, if you're wondering. Took one look at your depressing face and slunk backward into a toilet stall to escape the overwhelming stench of self-pity." She coughed, that old wheeze and something deeper. "Sorry it took us so long." I shook my head. "Please, no, don't apologize. I'm the one who can never apologize enough." "For what happened with Lenz? Or what you said to me before? Because, yeah, you don't know shit about what raised me, Moritz. It's not only freaks who have wretched upbringings." "For that, for everything, for things I can't even verbalize." I could hear the beeping of monitors all down the hallway, calling the surfaces of walls and floor and ceiling to life. Which were the sounds of Lenz? I pressed the heel of my hand against my chin, allowed my shaking fingers to cover my mouth. "Brilla? Are you crying?" "I'm eyeless," I said, I can't cry. Fika pulled my head onto her shoulder. Of course you can. I had not spoken to my mother in weeks. She had not allowed me to leave the laboratory since the anechoic incident. Sometimes I heard her weak heartbeat as she passed through the hallway outside my room, my cell. She never told me whether her love for me existed or was infinite. More than ever, she was unknowable. She would not look at me. Her feelings were never clear to me, or anyone else. You may think you do not know your mother because of her secrets, Ollie, but I knew my mother's secrets, and she was a stranger. Doctors advised me to stay in a wheelchair during recovery, advised me not to put further strain on my heart. Auburn Stash treated me as he does you. Moritz, please eat. I lacked your witty retorts. I only slumped. I only shivered. I had days like you've had, Ollie. Days when I did little more than sit alone in the cafeteria. We had not done well on the last inspection. Hardly any country sent representatives to visit. Two frowning men and a woman with arms folded, who only yawned at what I recall as triple-armed and reptile-scaled and heartless infants. I had become a resident, but the other children were leaving. One by one, walked or wheeled away. My mother knew that her work had not progressed in years. Perhaps the initiative's funding was being cut. A lot of her staff had followed after Merrill. Her broken children were not equipped to repair the world. My mother was a distant woman, but I cannot believe that she was heartless. She did not kill the children she dismissed from the facility. She allowed Auburn Stash to place them with their families, or in facilities and foster homes across the world. In cabins in the woods across the sea, Oliver. She was not so monstrous as to murder her failures. I think about her when I wake on weekend mornings. How far away she seemed, even when she carried me, heart to heart, hundreds of Saturdays ago, to my car seat. Maybe it wasn't the irregularity of her heartbeat that frightened me. Maybe it was the irregularity of her heart. My mother did not feel in the way others do. She processed the echoes of feelings. Their resonance did not reach her until long after the events that inspired them. She did not realize the pain she caused until it had reverberated for years. Maybe she felt that realization when I died. Maybe this was the real human reason she did not look at me. It was a November morning. I was sitting in the cafeteria with Dr. Auburn Stash. He was helping me study for a test that would determine whether I could attend gymnasium. I saw little point in it. I doubted I would ever leave the laboratory, let alone attend public school. I was by now aware of all the things I was not worthy of. He was always trying to make me feel like any other child. He encouraged me to get better at spelling if I could not read, to get better at speaking if I could not read. I was reciting the answers to division equations to him, and then, suddenly, I heard her absence. I said nothing of it. But as the day wore along and the remaining staff went about their business, dismantling machines and packing away equipment, no matter where I was in the hospital, I heard not a single pulse from her jarring heartbeat. At some point in the afternoon, Dr. Auburn Stash asked, "Moritz, have you seen her today?" I shook my head. He told me to wait where I was. He ground his teeth as he left. I began listening, as I was accidentally born to. I wheeled down the hallways, wheeled toward the elevator. Something gave me courage to ride that elevator down to the basement. There was only one place in the hospital that she could be. One place where I could not hear her. I knew she was in the anechoic chamber. The dreaded vault was open. I stood up from my wheelchair, felt a sharp dagger in my chest, pulls at my stitches, stepped towards the echoless void. The last thing I ever wanted was to re-enter it. And I couldn't, Ollie. I couldn't cross my power line. But I knew she was lying inside it. I knew. Dr. Auburn's stash appeared beside me, as he tends to. "What does she look like?" I said numbly. "I can't see her body."
"It isn't there, Moritz," he said. "She isn't in there, kiddo."
"How can I believe you?"
"I'm telling you, she's not here, Moritz."
"Then where is she?"
He shook his head. "I don't know. She's gone."
Dr. Arben's stash tried to lead me from the room. I dislodged his grasp. He left me to find help. I wanted to look in the chamber. I did not want to. I dared not. Auburn's stash returned, trailed by the janitor who'd saved me from drowning.
"I appreciate this, Herr Farber. I'll arrange somewhere more appropriate for him to stay as soon as possible."
The janitor nodded. As we left the room, I could feel the vibrations of Dr. Auburn's stash. He shook from head to foot. How long did it take for the echoes of us to reach him, Ollie? We left the laboratory through the parking garage. I would not return. The man who would later adopt me did not speak. He treated me to silence. Why bother with quiet? The quiet illuminates nothing. It is nothingness. It does not carry. It should not mean a thing. Still, I heard it over the noise of the car, and rested my face against the cold glass of the window. When I began clutching at my lurching heart halfway through the journey, when Herr Farber saw me gasping in his passenger seat, clicking to see the walls, to find something close that still existed, he reached forward and switched on the stereo. Bass and rhythmic speaking and horns. The first time I ever heard NWA, Ollie. Voices bidding me to express myself carried us from the darkness. I have not missed the laboratory. I have no idea whether it still functions. I do not ask Dr. Auburn's stash. He visits me every few weeks just as he visits you. Just as he visits other children like us. It is he who monitors the effectiveness of my pacemaker. He still tells me my mother is not dead, Oliver. She did not have an excuse so rich as her demise to explain why I am without her. She simply left me behind and vanished into the world. Not unlike the way she often vanished into her thoughts. The hospital room hadn't begun to take on aspects of a second home. There were no photos on the nightstand, few get-well cards. Lentz was not well-liked. Although he had been in this room for weeks, he had only been unconscious for a few hours after admission. He would be in the hospital for a while longer to be sure that his lungs did not fill with fluid or become infected for a second time. He had fractured a rib after all. Perhaps his chest twinges as mine does. He did not look half so thuggish as before, thin and propped on pillows. A tracheotomy tube dangling from his throat. Bandages around his skull. He no longer smelled of pumpernickel bread.
He did not want to see me. I did not want to see him. When I stepped around the curtain to face him, I wished that he would vanish as my mother did. But I can't let him rot, Ollie. He can't even speak properly right now. He has been made temporarily as mute as Owen. I was nearly petrified by all he could not say. Lenz tore his gaze from the window. I looked at him. I did not know how to begin. "Lenz," I said, "I don't know how to begin." He shook his head, closed his eyes. "I am wary of words. I thought I might say sorry, but did you ever say it? When you smashed my face into the floor? When you did the same to Owen? The others?" He opened his eyes, looked right at me. I took a deep breath. "Even so, I am sorry. I am sorry for all of us. All the time. Laboratory, or bakery, or basement apartment, or anywhere. I am sorry the world is frightening." I trailed off. Do not ask me if what I said made any impact on him. Perhaps he was plotting how best to beat me when he got back on his feet. Perhaps that is what I deserve. But if he aims a fist at me this time, Oliver, I will peel off my goggles. I will duck, but I will not hit back. Not if I can ever help it. Ollie is better at speeches. He narrowed his eyes. "That's his gay boy crush from across the sea, if you were wondering," said Fika from the doorway. Owen was standing beside her, fingers fluttering. All we misfits blinked at one another in silence, but I could hear every heartbeat, every bothered breath, the awkward shuffling of our feet, Lenz's hands clenching on his bedspread. "What?" Fika scowled at me. I didn't say anything. "You were looking at me." Owen sighed. "I am always looking at everyone. But since you've brought attention to it, have we begun to, clear the air? Should we all shake hands?" "Fluff off," Fika said. Even Owen cringed. Lenz mustered the strength to give me the finger. I was rushing things. Yet looking at us all, standing in one hospital room, bruised and battered with our aches of various origins, we were a comical bunch. "Perhaps you have seen a shitcom, Oliver. Perhaps I've shown you one." Father waited in the hallway. I could hear that some of his anxiety had shifted, had settled into the calmer depths of him. Was he relieved? His eyes widened when we met him. He blinked at Owen, at Fika. Did he almost speak? From nowhere, Frau Pruitt rushed forth, a bat out of Hades. I nearly would have rather ducked back inside and dealt with Lenz's glare again than face the sight of her toting books in her arms. It was as if she meant to beat me with them. Not steel, not titanium, adamantium. "You! You think any gymnasium will have you if you've dropped out of Hauptschule?" She deposited the stack of books into my arms. My shoulders sagged. She flicked me on the nose. "The transfer assessment. It's tomorrow morning at the Zentrumschule. 7 a.m. You'll be sitting the exam in a closed space with audio to assist you. You will be there. Any questions?" Would she drag me to the test center by the ears?
No questions. Thank you.
Good.
She showed her arched eyebrow to Fika, who had the grace to cow a bit in her presence. She eyed Owen. He grabbed my hand. His palm was warm and welcome.
And then, on Monday, you and your merry band of fools will be at school, and you'll be completing community service in the library.
Owen nodded. Fika chilled me with a smile.
Yes, ma'am. We'd be fluffin' delighted.
Will I wake up soon? I said to no one in particular. Will I, Ollie? Must I? Moritz.
Chapter 32. The Confetti. Dear Moritz, so much has happened to this lovesick hermit in the woods since I last wrote you. I hope you're all right, and I hope you passed your exam. I know you did, you clever doofus. It was nice to see so much hope in your last letter. Did you mean to put it there? It was the day of the Halloween dance. Mom was out in the garage somewhere, probably. I hadn't seen her since the power line fell. I hadn't seen her since I hurt her, Moritz. I was curled up under my blankets with my back to the door. I'd been lying like that for most of the past few days. I heard someone coming up the stairs. I knew those twitching footsteps. I thought about jumping out of bed and slamming the door. "What do you want?" I said, without turning. "Ollie," said Auburn Stash, "I've been in the garage." "What?" I looked at him out of the corner of my eye. "Why? You want my permission to jab needles into Mom, perform more tests, throw her in a water tank, make some more superhuman babies, stick a microchip in her head?" He sat down at the foot of the bed. He didn't look surprised. He didn't look anything. "It took so long for Moritz to tell you." "Yeah, well, maybe he didn't want me realizing I trusted a monster." He frowned. "Call me a monster, but don't say you can't trust me. I pulled you from a burning building. I've bandaged you more times than either of us can count. Are you trying to guilt me? You?" He put his head in his hands. "No, Oliver. It's just, I thought I had done right by you. Again, I don't know what you actually mean. Your father was my intern, you know." He pulled his hands away. "I put out an ad for a child therapist, and he applied while he was still a graduate student. It had hardly occurred to many of the staff that what these children needed was someone to care about their feelings." "Dad was a therapist?" I forgot to sound angry. "Therapists aren't so different from social workers, Moritz. Therapists don't cut people up." Maybe I was relieved. "He hoped to be, Ollie." Auburn Stash cleared his throat. "By the time he arrived, I was thoroughly disheartened by our whole enterprise. I had seen the amazing prototype that was Moritz, but I had also seen our failures. I had seen disembodied lungs that cried for air. I saw, oh kiddo, I saw things that should never have been." "Then why did you keep working there?" I raised my head. "I thought you were a good person." "The initiative began as a gathering of scientific minds interested in stopping disease. We had such ambition in the beginning." He put his finger up. "We were going to save lives, cure all but death." His finger curled inward. "The optimists dropped out early, when the first children emerged sickly. It wasn't only the subjects who mutated, but the scientists. Suddenly, I was surrounded by cold-eyed strangers who saw experiments rather than children. If I left, who would look after them? How many kids would drown? I have made mistakes, but I could not leave them." "He couldn't let you rot, Mo." "Then your father joined us, smirking on a winter's morning. Imagine it,
simply strolled right into my office with his hands in his pockets and asked me when he could meet everyone. I told him that there would be a staff meeting later that afternoon. "No," he said. "When can I meet the kids?" I took him to the children's ward, somewhat dumbfounded. He crossed his arms behind his head and chattered about how excited he was to be working there, about the heavy snowfall, about his beautiful fiancée he had met on campus, a girl who played guitar and was expecting. When I unlocked the second door and we entered the ward in our protective suits, I expected him to recoil. Some of the specimens in those days were scarce recognizable as human beings. Some of them were radioactive. Others were not much more than wriggling feelers. But your father paused at every bed, every cell and container, to greet each and every one of them. He asked them for their names. When they lacked the ability or the organs to reply, he asked me to speak for them. "Hey," he told them, "I'm Seb. What's it like to be you?" Some of the children spoke to him. Some of the children reached for him, and he never flinched. Some of them betrayed their humanity for the first time. The ward became a nursery. We both missed the staff meeting entirely. When we finally left the room, I followed in his wake. I could not think of what to say. In the face of his optimism, I felt like an infant. I felt ancient. When we returned to my office, he gestured for me to sit down at my own desk. "Don't think I've forgotten about you," he said. "What's it like to be you, Dr. Auburn Stash?" Auburn Stash paused to clear his throat. I stared at my hands on the bedspread, wriggling feelers. "So, he got sick because he spent so much time with sick kids?" "We can't be sure, Ollie," Auburn Stash sighed. "Cancer comes from so many places. Your father may have been sick even before I met him. I mean, I always assumed that he died because, I don't know, he and Mom volunteered for daring genetic experiments or something. In my head, it was a lot more adventurous. You told me it wasn't science fiction, Mo, but I wanted to believe in storytelling." "Your mother did undergo experimental treatment, Ollie, but only because she nearly miscarried in the early months of her pregnancy. Only because there were signs you'd be unwell." "What?" My heart beat in my ears. "I didn't think I would be able to keep you. Seb, your father, told me that he had undisclosed motives for joining the lab. 'The doctors say something might be wrong with the baby,' he told me. We were in my office. 'Maybe the same something I've got. Probably something worse. Hard to tell.' I remember that I sighed. I had thought your father was entirely selfless and here solely for the sake of the kids. But it was also for the sake of his own. I was disappointed until I saw the tears in his eyes. 'We need help, Greg.' 'And you come to me,' I told him. 'I can't promise that we've helped anyone here. You've met the children. You've seen how many of them suffer. We have no idea what the long-term effects are on the subjects or their mothers. Think of your fiancée. Thinking isn't my area, but Meredith and I have talked, which is something I am good at. People suffer everywhere. At least in this place, you guys are working on it, right?"
That's right.
Your father had a lot of faith, a lot of hope in the initiative. He saw it as what it was founded as, a place that helped people. He wouldn't have thought twice about using it to help his wife and son. He had not seen the gradual shift in purpose. Beyond that, he did not see failures as failures, only as people. This story wasn't the heroic one I'd wanted, Moritz. My dad really did sound just like some big kid. So Dad just gave Mom experimental treatment as if he didn't care that she might get sick? I clenched my fists. He was an idiot.
Don't ever say that, said Auburn Stash. It worked. He saved you.
Saved me?
Wow, bully for the world.
Don't you dare sit there and shrug as though that means nothing. That is everything, Ollie. Every goddamn thing to your mother and me.
I had never seen Auburn Stash like this. I had never seen him look so terrible and sad and scared and tired of it all. And I shut my mouth because I probably looked the same way. After a moment, I nodded.
Okay. Okay.
Auburn Stash stood and walked to the window. His fingers flicked against the glass.
Your father spent so much time with the unknown, at his own expense. But when he got sicker, he was still smiling. He sat in my office and he asked me when he knew that was it for him. When he aged before my eyes and strolled no longer. When the optimism left him empty. He asked me to look after you. Even though I was standing there with syringes and all those screaming children behind me, with countless experiments already done and nameless more on the horizon. Your father trusted me with his unborn son. And after he was gone, after you were born, and I took you out to the woods, I knew what you were to me. Even while I was still working at the lab, I could visit you. I could visit your happiness, your mom's. I wanted to scream, but he looked so old with his head in his hands, like someone's grandfather or something. I've spent so long trying to be a better person. I like to think that for you, I was. You redeemed me. His voice was hoarse. After he was gone, that was all I had.
What about all the others? The other kids?
Ah, he swallowed. Yes. I visit some of them, but it's not enough, is it? Perhaps I haven't actually done a decent job here, either.
I'm fine. Anger took too much energy, and no one had ever really talked to me about Dad before. That was something, I guess. Words are the next closest thing to meeting someone. He winced and pulled the package you'd sent out from under his seat.
What's this?
It's a womble. Supposed to be electricity-proof, I guess.
Yes, he said, peering inside. We used to wear ones just like it.
And you never thought to give me one? I mumbled. Auburn Stash's eyes flashed with that old manic gleam.
Oh, I did think of it. You should see the solutions I designed for you, Ollie. Non-conducting body suits and rock wool caps to obscure the sensitive pressure points at your temples. Rubber headbands with skin-tight seals. I drew up plans for a translucent lotion that hardened into a second insulated skin and would ideally be invisible to those who weren't looking for it. God, did I plot for you to live like everyone else. I plotted for you to leave here.
I sat up straight.
Then why haven't I? Oliver, said Auburn Stash. The risk went beyond your safety. I fear that you are just as likely to make the world tremble as it is to make you seize. So long as you're growing, you lack control of your emotions. So long as you lack control of your emotions, you lack control of your electromagnetic tendencies. What do you think would happen if you got upset on a freeway and stalled every vehicle alongside you? What if you removed your womble at an airport and sneezed a plane from the sky?
Auburn Stash smirked, but it was a dark smirk.
Other lads worry about their voices cracking, but Ollie, you've never been other lads.
I tried not to think about the phone that hit Liz's face. The power line blown apart. Mom telling me I'd only hurt people.
You think I'd murder phones, I said quietly. I don't think you'd ever intentionally hurt a soul on the planet. But fate is cruel.
No shicksal, Sherlock, I said. Auburn Stash lifted the arm of the womble, ran his fingers along its surface.
Why did he send it, Oliver?
Because he loves me, I guess.
Really?
He choked on a laugh.
Well, what do you know?
And, I slumped into my pillows again, for a Halloween dance I'm not going to, because dances are juvenile. I could hear Auburn Stash's shuddery fingers squeezing the plastic, and his laughter was gone again.
Oliver, I need you to put this on. Go away!
Auburn Stash held up the womble with shaking hands.
You need to put it on.
I didn't want to hear it. I bit my lip and closed my eyes, but heard it anyway.
Oliver, she may never leave the garage again.
Minutes after he left, I climbed out of bed, pieced it together, pulled it on, and stood in front of the mirror. Not a freak. Wicked. Auburn Stash waited for me at the foot of the stairs. Will it work? I said through the filtered mouth of the gas mask. Sweating, I lifted one heavy arm of the thick rubber-coated canvas suit.
It should.
Moistness in his eyes, fogging his glasses. It took a while to get the hang of walking in the suit, but Auburn Stash helped me traverse the lawn, walking ahead and pointing me around dips in the grass as we approached the overwhelming red-gold luminescence of the garage. It was dusk, and the building was glowing like some alien mothership. My breath caught in my throat as I stepped right into the light. I didn't seize. The red electricity gently tickled the lines of my suit and let me be. Auburn Stash held the door open for me. I entered the garage. There were things in there I'd known about. A freezer, her truck, a phone tacked to the wall, rainbow bursts of color. But there was also a lot more. What was in the garage was a hospital bed. IVs and monitors and cabinets full of medication. A sink and a toilet and a hazardous waste bag. And a leather chair that I recognized as being the sort of place people sat during chemotherapy. Mom, I whispered. She was lying in the middle of the setup, entirely bald and thin and looking like a child, tubes in her arms and in her nose. And I wondered whether her brain was still in her head or if it had finally been eaten away. The light of the machinery she was attached to shrouded her in half the color spectrum. She blinked at me, a bit blearily, as I approached. I wanted to hug her, but I worried I would dislodge a tube or hurt her or crush her. Why didn't I hug her the day she told me summer was over? Why was I awful to her? Why didn't I wear the coat? It was raining, and she was just worried about me, but I was so...
Focus, Ollie. You'll knock her dead with that costume, she gasped. I made a corsage for you to give her. With a fiery chrysanthemum. In the freezer.
Mom, I shouldn't have said... I mean, I know you're trying to help me.
It's old hat. And the dance starts soon, right?
She clenched my hand in hers, a skeleton grip on my rubber gloves. There was no way I was going to the dance. But Auburn Stash stepped forward with the corsage in hand. The orange mum was framed in maroon aster petals. She'd spent a few months last year arranging flowers. Another lost hobby. Mom, dances. There's something. I mean, dances are juvenile. But her tears slipped down the canvas on my arms, and she shook her head.
I promised I'd let you go.
Right then, I didn't want her to. What did you used to do on rainy days, Mom? She smiled.
Puddle hopping, Oliver.
We took her truck, whatever color it was. We approached the broken power line and I held my breath. But with the womble, I almost hated how easy it was to drive under it. I breathed a sigh into the mask when we passed unhindered below the limp tendrils. They were as threatening as spaghetti noodles. They didn't mean a damn thing, Moritz. I could see enough through the goggles and the windshield to know that the engine was propelling us forward at speeds my bike could never achieve. I didn't seize, despite the dizzying bouts of color that assailed me as he drove. I had never looked out car windows before, but I didn't enjoy it much. I kept thinking of how Mom tried to smile as we pulled out of the garage. She tried,
and it hurt to breathe when I thought about it. But at least I wasn't seizing. Either the womble was working or I had fooled myself. We pulled onto the main roads of town. Piercing cobalts and ceruleans swarmed around billboards, jabs of amber lashed out from street lamps. Congealing browns overtook us as we passed other drivers. I didn't appreciate it like I should have. Auburn Stash kept glancing at me, as if looking away might puncture the suit. When we pulled up in front of the school, I struggled to breathe. There were people out there, heading from the darkness to the colors of the flat-roofed building. I almost whimpered. This is crazy. What are we doing? Sometimes you have to take a plunge, for better or for worse. He helped me out of the truck and tucked a wad of cash into my hand. For tickets. Oh, yeah, money. That's a thing.
It is.
Come pick me up at 10, okay? I tried to sound confident. I thought I was hallucinating.
There are all kinds of adventures in the world, Ollie.
I stumbled into the school alongside other monstrous shapes, flinching away from light bulbs overhead, twitching at the sight of phones in hands and the feel of the beat emanating through the floor. Both my fists were closed. I handed a mummy at the ticket table $10. He gestured to the double doors that said, Gym.
That room was sensory murder. The usual pain wasn't there, but I could feel the weight of electricity suffused around me. The colors were unbearable. I could hardly see the dancers and the DJ through the clouds in the air around them. Individual shades, individual auras were impossible to pluck out. They were tangled and smeared together in a seething mass that circumvented dozens of laughing kids. It could have been worse. I think it was easier for me to see witches, superheroes, and vampires through womble eyes than it would have been to see normal teenagers through my own. Of course I recognized her, even in costume. Liz's dress was black with glow-in-the-dark bones on it. Her torso looked like the model skeleton in my room. Her face had been paled with makeup. She put shadows under her eyes, beneath her cheekbones. She looked like me, only beautiful. But she wasn't standing alone. She was attached to a blonde boy dressed as a knight in foil armor. If I kicked him between the legs, I'd probably be kicking homemade chainmail. I trudged to her, pushing against dancers who swore at me. The suit was working, but it wouldn't for long. The hot perspiration, the flashing from all sides, and the din of voices that I was unaccustomed to, the onslaught of light. I was being smothered. Colors swallowed me as I reached for her. My glove wrapped around her arm. She pulled away.
The heck?
Hey! Martin Mulligan squinted at me, half smiling. Who's this? Ryan? Great costume, man.
I unclenched my other fist and pushed Liz's corsage and music player into her hand. I'd cleaned the blood and water off. She frowned at it. Then her eyes looked straight into my goggles.
Ollie?
Liz!
I spoke as loudly as I could. The heat was excruciating. I pointed at the DJ.
Electronica?
Ollie, what? How?
Through the haze, I think I saw her eyes widen.
No, Biggie.
My legs gave out. Martin Mulligan caught me with cardboard arms.
Man, you're hyperventilating. Take that thing off.
I can't.
Martin misunderstood. He thought he was helping me. That was the worst thing, knowing that he really was a decent guy. Maybe I would have liked him after all, the bastard.
No!
Cried Liz.
Here,
said Martin Mulligan, and he yanked my gas mask off. My head exploded. A barrage of malevolent electricity stabbed me in the eye sockets. It was beyond pain. It was concentrated anguish at the base of my neck, expanding and searing as I waited for my brains to splatter onto my shoes. I screamed as blood vessels in my eyes burst, as my hands started flapping. I screamed twice as loud as I ever had until the sound reverberated up to the gymnasium rafters. And when I fell to the floor, I screamed even louder, and my skull threw itself against the wood. I screamed. The world ended, and I wanted it to end. because it was finally too much. And I mean all of it was too much. All of it was swirling through my skeleton and nerves until it was imploding inside me in this twisted spiral of pain or something so much worse. And I swear that lights switched over in my eyes, and then I saw more than Liz beside me, horrified in the gym. I saw my dad tripping over his untied laces, but all the wriggling feelers stretching out of incubators were ready to catch him. I saw daylilies sprouting from dilapidated birthday cake no one ever ate. I saw the fishbowl in shards painted redder than blackberry juice. Liz's hand getting sucked back into the cardboard television. Joe flying right back up into his tree. The automobile bones in the junkyard creaking and standing up on huge metal stilts with feet at the ends. I saw Dorian Gray lit with electricity, and I saw us wearing layers of mud puddles as thick as winter coats, and I saw planes go down because I sneezed, and I saw all sorts of things I could never see, and the weight of it all was pulling me under, and I could have happily fallen back into the feelers of the things in incubators too, right? That seemed easiest. But then I saw you. You were in the deer blind again, Moritz. I saw you, smiling, with holes in your face, reaching down into the collapsing chamber of things that held me, saying only, "It was never your fault," and pulling me up and out and closer to you. It was almost like I met you, Mo. And the thought of that was enough to send all of the imploding mass of horror spinning out of me all at once in a roaring scream that no one heard, that no words, no all caps, could capture. So the world only ended for the DJ. All his speakers blew out in the exact instant that his laptop died. The lights above sputtered, went out. Phones sparked and people dropped them. All that was electric died with my scream. I made the world convulse instead. I was on my back. The sound of stampeding, costumed teenagers shouting in the dark shook me to the bones. "Is he okay?" Martin Mulligan, my knight? Screw that. I'll get help. His footsteps joined those of the exiting, hollering masses. I opened my eyes. Liz was leaning over me. I could see her face in the glow of her skeleton dress, although it hurt to stare through the red haze of broken blood vessels. "I brought the house down," I said, all stumbling tongue. "You're crazy." Her relief was almost tangible, like another color. I didn't look away. "You want to dance? You didn't bring your Glockenspiel." She laughed, or maybe choked. I could see her eyes, just barely. She didn't look bored. I thought her freckles were piercing through the makeup, and when she hugged me in the emptying gym, a current passed between us. She held out her hand. "Do you want to stand, Ollie?" A hint of that old grin. "Or do you want to lie there and bleed some more?" I stood. Liz and I kicked balloons and untangled orange and black streamers from our shoes. We stepped out of the school through a fire exit. I was riding some kind of high, face open to the air, dragging my gas mask behind me. I was still grinning like an idiot as she pulled me away from the school, despite the blood cooling on my face. The street lamps overhead burst as I passed under them. When the first bulb shattered, Liz yelped, and I ended up dragging her, too. But the air was cool and fresh and new, and there was blacktop under my feet for the first time ever, and I wanted to think only of this moment. But she stopped halfway across the large parking lot to catch her breath, and we were alone, and I didn't even know what to say. I looked at her and peeled my womble farther down from my face. We walked slowly across the remainder of the lot. It just felt like we should keep moving, or I would have to stop and think, and I did not want to. "So you beat the power line," she said. There was pumpkin-shaped confetti in her hair. "I had help. But hey, maybe you can start coming to school here now." Overhead, another street light went out. I felt the slightest release of pressure in my temple as the colors faded, but nothing more. "I'm not sure that's the best idea. Who needs computers if you've got origami?" she was beaming. It'll work. We'd stopped walking, standing behind the lone vehicle in the back lot, an old minivan that made me nostalgic. When I stood near it, my stomach clenched and its black smog vanished. Maybe we were going to kiss again. But I've got a better idea. I know that look, she said, but I didn't want to think about why she was frowning or why maybe I should be frowning too, so I grabbed her hand and pulled her forward, toward the road that ran behind the school. We could go anywhere. Where do you think we should go, Liz? Where's a good place to eat? Maybe a sushi joint, because I'd probably take out ovens if I got too close. And after that, how do you feel about Kreitzig? I don't know whether I could get on a plane. I chortled, yanking her forward, walking down the yellow lines in the road. I forgot that roads had such a thing. Genius. Ollie! Liz cowered as another bulb burst overhead. Can't you shut it off? I mean, maybe if I got in a plane it would crash, but maybe not. Maybe I could rein it in a bit. Or we could get a skiff. Either way, I'll see the ocean. The ocean, Liz. I bet confessions are even bigger at ocean sunsets. Stands to reason. Liz pulled her hand away. I couldn't see her expression beneath the makeup, but her teeth were showing. You're manic again. No, no, I'm not. I showed my teeth, too. Just excited. What's happened? Man, she knows me well, Moritz. My smile slipped. And as it did, I felt queasy. The electric aura from the next streetlight suddenly seemed stronger than I was, and I took a step back. Nothing's happened, I said. I just don't want to go home. Ollie, she said, calm down. Breathe. She put her hands on my shoulders. Since when was I crouching? Is it your mom? I didn't answer. She helped me up and started walking me back toward the school, back across the parking lot. That womble was so heavy. My feet were so heavy. Come on, pull on your mask. Let's go. Auburn Stash. He isn't coming back until 10 p.m. I'll drive. I wasn't lying about driver's training. It didn't end there, Moritz. But the moments I have left with Mom are running out, and right now I'd rather be at her bedside than writing you. Thanks for the womble. Send me more hope.
Chapter 33. The Microphone. Ollie, I would pull you from every darkness if ever I met you. Bernhold Regan did not welcome our merry band back with willing arms, but it seemed Lenz's father truly had influence. I had feared he would want to pursue further punishment for me. Facing him in the hospital had been even harder than facing Lenz. The way he'd stared at me with bags beneath his eyes, cracking his dry knuckles. But he'd said, "My son has been known to ask for trouble. I told the authorities he fell from the bridge. I told them not to trace the emergency call. I told them he is clumsy, like me." "He fell?"
"I know some of what he's done to you, to the other boy who frightened him."
"Frightened him?"
"Goodness knows he's hospitalized a classmate before. Goodness knows I did in my day. Like father, like son."
He tried to chuckle. It didn't reach his eyes.
"Clumsy, like me."
He sighed a deep sigh that seemed to reach the bottom of him.
"I did not mean to raise him like me.
I'm as clumsy as he is." I felt his eyes crinkle up.
"You were also raised by someone. We follow examples. I have been a bad example since his mother passed. I shooed you from my bakery years ago. What was I teaching him?"
"But it has to be more than following examples," I told him. I have to be more than that.
Maybe you are. Some of us never get there.
I heard his bones creak. His knuckles tightened on his knees.
It is very hard to be human.
I clutched my shoulders. It really is. He held out one cracked hand. With a burning throat, I shook it. His palm was as warm as mine. Fika and Owen awaited my arrival in the courtyard at school. My heart leapt, Ollie, but this was not a sign of breathlessness or fear. I didn't pay much attention to what the other students were doing. It was enough that the Arbens were chattering away, sending their own waves back to me, not in color but in vivid detail. Owen laughed and wiggled his fingers. He's trying to teach me sign language. It is as difficult as reading. Pruitt demands I keep up with reading. She handed me a stack of manga the other day, which must please you, Ollie. As we walked, Fika said she might actually attend class for once. Her teacher will wonder when Susie Sue registered for his course. Ha! We shared lunch together. I spoke. Owen spoke in his way, holding my hand beneath the table. I doubt you will mind, Oliver, despite your kind words about meetings under power lines. This is not science fiction, but I almost feel I am in a fantasy world. Except when I think of you. This is not fantasy. In a fantasy world, your mother would not be in such pain. And neither would you. If I could tell you this in person, you could hear the truth in my voice. But perhaps one day I shall meet you, now that you have the Womble. After all, you overcame the power line. Perhaps one day you'll be able to find the happy medium between your polarities, between rejecting electricity and it rejecting you. I am not afraid that you will hurt me. If you do, the scars won't last for eternity. People hurt each other all the time, especially when they care for each other. Lately, I have been dwelling. I asked Father where the laboratory that made us is. I had no idea whether it was still operational, whether it still smelled of antiseptic and windowlessness. My father wrote the latitude and longitude down.
I never thought you'd ask for this, he said as he wrote.
Neither did I said. But... He nodded. Vergangen Heights Bewältigung. At the sickly poet, I laid the folded coordinates before Fika and Owen. What's this? You couldn't even throw it at me? She said, while Owen unfolded the paper airplane. I am only capable of the simplest origami, Ollie. Owen's eyes widened. He signed a symbol similar to hospital to my untrained ears. Fika frowned in a clinking sound. You mean the place where you were raised? Owen frowned at me as well, or perhaps frowned at the obnoxious racket that the current performer was making on the evening stage, wailing ineptly along to K-pop songs. Help, Ollie. Why the fluff would you want to go back there? Are you looking for your sociopathic mother? She wasn't sociopathic, and no. Fika opened her mouth. Owen put his hand up to her face and nodded. I was hoping one of you could Google how I can get there, if it isn't too much trouble. Owen held the unfolded plane close to his face, set it down again, moved his hands at Fika. Owen can find anything online. So when are we going? I shook my head. I don't expect you to accompany me. God, you're a prat, said Fika. Owen kicked her under the table. He looked frightened, but he pointed to himself. Once this might have upset me. Their recklessness, their curiosity about the source of my childhood.